Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this is Chemistry World Podcast number 10 with me, Chris Smith, and with the Chemistry World team, Mark Peplow, B. Perks, Richard Van Norden, James Mitchell Crowe, and Victoria Gill. In this month's edition of the programme, there's a new kid on the anti-smoking block. But how does it work?
It's what's known as a partial agonist, so it doesn't have the same full effect that nicotine does. But what it does have is enough of an effect to reduce the withdrawal symptoms and the cravings. So if you do have a cigarette, then it's not so satisfying or rewarding, so you're less likely to go back to smoking.
Robert West with guidance on the best ways to quit, and he's coming up in just a moment. Also, biochemical credence for the Atkins diet.
A team at the University of Southwestern seem to have found the hormone that's responsible for the fat burning that happens during the Atkins diet. If you subject mice to a ketogenic diet, basically an Atkins diet, very high in fat, high in protein, but very low in carbohydrates, you see a high production of FGF21.
And researchers discover why you can still feel pain even when your hands go numb with the cold.
And when they put these mice on blocks of ice, they couldn't feel a thing. They just stood calmly on the ice and, you know, they would have frozen solid.
Ouch. Mind you, a mutation in that gene would probably come in very handy on a cold day, rather like we're having this summer. Well, that's all coming up, along with this month's chemical conundrum. We wanted to find out why orange juice tastes so disgusting after you've just cleaned your teeth. Don't believe me? Well, go and give it a try. But before you do that, great news for the aerospace industry, and even for my wife, who's fond of denting our car, because researchers have come to the rescue, Bee. What have they done?
I've got polymers that can heal themselves and heal themselves over and over again, which is a real first.
How do they work?
Well, first of all, this is Nancy Satos's team at the University of Illinois in the States. And she's used a direct write technique to create an epoxy resin base that's infused with a network of horizontal and vertical channels, 200 micrometer, something a bit like capillaries you might find in the blood system. But rather than having blood in them, they have a healing agent, very low viscosity monomeric dicyclopentadiene. On top of that vascularized layer, they put a solid epoxy resin layer into which is incorporated a catalyst called Grubbs catalyst, one of the catalysts that Robert Grubbs managed to win the 2005 Chemistry Nobel Prize for developing. So what happens is when the polymer is injured by a crack that forms at the very top of the surface and goes down through the epoxy resin layer with the Grubbs catalyst, and it gets down to the bottom where there's this almost sort of blood supply of healing agent. And by capillary action, that's drawn up through the layer with the catalyst in it. So when it meets the catalyst, it polymerizes and heals the wound.
But surely, you said it could do it again and again and again, but surely it's restricted to actually how much of the healing agent is there, or is there some kind of endless reservoir?
Presumably it's relatively endless. The reason that the other ones didn't last forever and ever was because the catalyst was in capsules in that epoxy resin layer. So once it was in capsules, of course, you only could use a very limited amount of catalyst, but this is all the way through the epoxy resin. So you're not going to run out of it.
Does it heal cleanly? Is it a sort of scar-free heal? Or do you end up with a mark?
Well, I have to say, the pictures they have in the paper, there are marks. But, I mean, that's so heavily magnified that I think to the naked eye, it would be pretty smoothly mended.
And where would you see this being applied? Where do they suggest this should be deployed?
Well, we spoke to Ian Bond at the Aerospace Composites Research Group at the University of Bristol, who's very excited about it because in aerospace, you don't want to have things that might get injured up in space. But if they mend themselves, hurrah.
Pretty harsh conditions in space, though.
Well, then, now, that's the next thing. So this paper was published in Nature Materials. The same team published in the Royal Society's journal Interface a very similar system, but they used a different catalyst because the Grubbs catalyst apparently is expensive and it has limited temperature stability. And goodness knows what temperatures they're going to be facing in the aerospace industry.
Well, I guess we'll just have to watch this space with that one. But it certainly sounds intriguing. And sticking with the sort of science of the very small and ultra structures, people are blowing nano bubbles. James, what's this all about?
That's right. Scientists in Harvard have found a much improved way to incorporate nanoparticles into polymer films. What they've done is taken a liquid mixture of the polymer and the nanoparticles, and they've effectively blown a bubble of it. It's a process called blown film extrusion. It's the technique that's used to make things like bin bags So not a terribly expensive thing to do.
So you just get a giant bubble of polymer with the particles embedded in it, but do they therefore form organised structures in the bubble, or are they all over the place?
No, they're actually very well aligned.
But why?
Well, that's a question that Charles Lieber, who has led the research, hasn't yet worked out, although he told Chemistry World he was very excited that they did line up. And not only do they all line up, but they're all distributed very evenly throughout the film, whereas other techniques to incorporate nanoparticles into polymer films, they've tended to end up with clumps.
So how big are these bubbles, James?
Well, the biggest that they've made so far are about 20 by 30 centimetres, but the Harvard team think that there should be no problem with making these composites on metre scale.
So what you would do is make a giant bubble and then chop it up into small bubbles or small pieces that you can then use.
Exactly, and you can make flexible pieces or pieces that have natural curve to them.
And it works with any material. You should be able to get any kind or species of nanoparticle and it will accommodate those.
Exactly. The team have shown that you can use nanowires and carbon nanotubes, so you could use these as sensors. And the fact that all the wires are lined up means that they should be able to be incorporated into some sort of circuitry as a detector for gases or potentially even chemical warfare agents. And using the carbon nanotubes, these could be used for very strong coatings. So, for example, you might paint them onto aeroplane wings, for example. And if you could get enough of the nanotubes into the polymer, then you could end up with a material that's even stronger than Kevlar.
Thanks, James. And now to something else that's even tougher than Kevlar, that's giving up cigarettes. Now that smoking's banned across Britain, at least in public, there's never been a better time to bite the bullet and give up. So I asked UCL's Robert West how worshippers of the weed should go about it.
Percentage of people smoking is about 28% in the UK adult population. And of those, if you ask random samples at any one time, you find that about 70% will say, yes, they'd like to stop smoking. And you find that about 50% will have made at least one quit attempt in the last year.
But James Bond said, giving up smoking's easy, I've done it hundreds of times. So why have you got 75% of people wanting to quit and hardly any of them succeeding?
Well, you know, we use the term addiction, but essentially it does come down to nicotine, but it's a bit more complicated than people think. The way that nicotine works is not in the sort of classic way that people think of drug addiction. In other words, that you have to have a particular nicotine level in the brain in order to be able to function normally. Nicotine actually operates in a somewhat more complex way to make the cigarette itself addictive by a process of association.
So how do we actually get people off them? Because is it just a case of supplementing the nicotine? If it were that easy, you'd think that people would be able to stop smoking, but it doesn't seem to work.
No. First of all, one has to realise that you're talking about a behaviour, and any sort of behaviour pattern is going to have a whole range of factors that contribute to it. And essentially, the way that we go about it is to look at both the psychological side as well as the pharmacological side. And essentially what you're doing with the psychological side is you're bolstering the motivation to stop. And what you can do is to use a whole range of tricks, group pressure, empathy, all kinds of things, to just add enough motivational force to keep them from having that cigarette. What we do on the pharmacological side is reduce the motivation to smoke, and there are a number of ways of doing that. Obviously, there's the nicotine replacement therapies, nicotine patch, gum, inhaler, lozenge, nasal spray, etc. There's Zyban, otherwise known as bupropion, which is a stimulant drug also used as an antidepressant. And then there's a new medication called Champix or varenicline, which works by binding with very high affinity to the particular kinds of nicotinic receptor subtype with what are known as alpha-4 beta-2 subunits in, which lie at the heart of nicotine addiction, so that nicotine cannot get on there. And it's what's known as a partial agonist, so it doesn't have the same full effect that nicotine does, but what it does have is enough of an effect to reduce the withdrawal symptoms and the cravings. So if you do have a cigarette, then it's not so satisfying or rewarding, so you're less likely to go back to smoking in full force.
So if you look at all these different interventions, how successful is each of them if you sort of rank them? What's the best thing to try and do to get off?
I would say if you don't know anything about the smoker, about what the history is, apart from the fact that they're a smoker, and assuming they're not contraindicated for it, I would go for Champix plus professional behavioural support of the kind that is available in the NHS Stop Smoking Service.
And how many people, if you subjected them to that, would you expect on a good day will successfully give up?
About 20 to 25% would be completely smoke-free for a year, of whom we would expect about 30 to 40% to relapse at some point later on.
What happens if someone's just eager to try the chewing gum? How well would they do?
They would probably do somewhere between 15 and 20%, something like that, with behavioural support as well. With the medications on their own, then the success rates are somewhat lower, because you're just dealing with, obviously, one side of the equation.
And when July the 1st kicks in, what sort of impact is this going to have on people's motivation? Will this help?
Yes, it does. People do try to give up in anticipation. They also try to give up on the day. But experience from Ireland has indicated that actually more people try to stop once the sort of reality that it's become a bit more difficult to smoke kicks in. The problem that they found in Ireland and in Scotland is that people won't use effective treatments and most will relapse. The government has estimated that in England it might cause maybe 600,000 people to stop smoking, but I would be amazed if it was more than about 100,000 to 200,000, which is still, you know, a lot of people, a lot of lives saved, but it's nothing like the sort of impact that one would hope.
UCL's Robert West explaining how to do what even James Bond wasn't capable of, give up smoking. Coming up, we'll be continuing our lifestyle theme to this month's Chemistry World podcast with a look at how to make your skin look younger. But first, how about losing some weight too? Well, if you're tempted by the Atkins regime, then new research suggests that you may well be on solid biochemical ground. What's this all about, Victoria?
A team at the University of Southwestern seem to have found the hormone that's responsible for the fat burning that happens during the Atkins diet.
So it's not just a load of rubbish. There is actually credence given to what Atkins suggested in terms of eating a high-fat diet and losing
weight. There seems to be biochemical credence to Atkins after all. It's actually a dual publication of two studies that back up this factor. So a group led by Stephen Cleaver at the University of Southwestern in the US, and he was studying some receptors called PPAR-alpha in the liver that are connected to metabolism. And he found that they were stimulated by this particular growth factor, a hormone called fibroblast growth factor 21, FGF21.
But what was the connection between that and Atkins diets then?
Well, because he found that these particular receptors were stimulated by this hormone, he decided to look at the hormone. And what he found was that the hormone stimulated fat metabolism in the liver. And at the same time, a group at the University of Boston found that if you subject mice to a ketogenic diet, basically an Atkins diet, very high in fat, high in protein, but very low in carbohydrates, you see a high production of this FGF21.
And if you give this to normal mice, does it then fool them into thinking they're on the Atkins diet and therefore they lose weight?
That's exactly what Stephen Cleaver's group did. They used transgenic mice that produced a lot of FGF21 and direct injections of FGF21. And despite the fact that the mice were on a normal diet, they looked like they were starving. They were burning a lot of fat. What they do is when a person's starving and when it has very few carbohydrates to burn, which is a normal energy source, a food source, you'll start to burn lipids or fat stores. This is why the diet's called ketogenic, because you'll produce ketones, which are a different type of fuel for your tissues.
Have they looked in humans to see if the same effect is true? Because that must be the critical thing.
Not yet, no. This is early days, early studies in mice. This is something that they will take forward into obesity research. But in actual fact, Stephen Cleaver's next step is to look at the link between FGF21 and aging. He's very interested in the link between calorie restriction, diet, and longevity. There have been a lot of previous studies that have shown that animals on a calorie-restricted diet live longer. And a few scientists that I spoke to that are involved in that research are now wondering, could the Atkins diet actually make you live longer? There's actually an active group in the UK who are undergoing their own personal experiment to stay on a calorie-restricted diet to see if they live longer. I mean, it's impossible to prove, but it's interesting.
I spoke with some of those people and they said, yeah, you may not live longer through calorie restriction, but you're so miserable that life seems to last twice as long. Richard, there's a very interesting piece of work which has been done on why it is that you can still feel the cold despite having completely numb hands and feet.
Well, we all know the sting of winter air and the real agony of moving our frozen fingers. And now scientists have discovered exactly why extreme cold does hurt. They've even managed to create mice who can stand on blocks of ice without feeling any pain. Now, it might be a surprise that we should feel pain in the cold, because as Katharina Zimmermann of the University of Erlangen in Germany explained to me, and she led this research, we feel pain when protein channels let sodium ions flow across the membranes of neurons, and that fires off electrical nerve impulses.
So in the cold, you'd expect them to work more slowly, and therefore the nerves would signal more slowly or less effectively, and so you should, in the same way as you go numb, feel less pain.
Exactly. It turns out that there are different types of sodium channels doing this job. One, NaV 1.7, fires very fast, very low threshold. Another, NaV 1.8, fires more slowly, the threshold is much higher. But what Zimmermann and her colleagues found was that as the temperature went down, NaV 1.7 got much slower and it got sensitized to the cold and nothing seemed to be happening. But NaV 1.8 really came into its own. It was really responsible for feeling the pain at very extreme cold temperatures.
So does this suggest it's a sort of evolutionary protector? It's there so that it does remain active in the cold and warns us, hey, you might be in danger of getting frostbite in this bit of your body.
Yeah, it seems to be a primitive ion channel. No one was really quite sure what it was there for. And now that's the first clue we've got. Now, what's interesting is that the team teamed up with John Wood at the University of London in UK, and he helped them create mice which didn't have this NaV 1.8 ion channel at all. And when they put these mice on blocks of ice, they couldn't feel a thing. They just stood calmly on the ice and, you know, they would have frozen solid if the
researchers hadn't
removed them.
This suggests it may be actually beneficial for humans, because there are some human clinical conditions where cold triggers extreme pain states. So identifying this receptor or this particular channel could be very useful in helping to treat those people then.
Yes, you're talking about allodynia, which is when people suffer from biting pains even when temperatures are normal. Now, it's actually been a real challenge to find drugs that act against NaV 1.8 because it's actually so similar to NaV 1.7. But in May this year, US companies Abbott and Icagen did announce a potent drug which blocked the ion channel in rats, which is really quite an achievement. And it's thought that maybe that might help people who suffer from cold allodynia.
Now there's a result you can warm to. Thanks, Richard. To China now. Last month, we heard from Mark Peplow how China's rapidly becoming a chemical powerhouse, particularly in the area of the hunt for cleaner fuels. In the second of his dispatches from China, Mark finds out how universities are increasingly opening up to international collaboration.
Chemistry is booming in China. The enormous investment in science and technology here, along with a real conviction that science and development go hand in hand, has made the subject enormously popular with undergraduate students. To find out more about the state of academic chemistry in China, I went to the Beijing University of Chemical Technology to meet Professor David Evans. David started his academic career in the UK, but in 1996 he started to collaborate with Professor Duan here in Beijing. I asked him what convinced him to move out here for good.
Although at that time in 1996 the conditions were vastly inferior to UK or elsewhere in the West, then I could see that there was real potential for development. And I thought, well, if I don't take this chance, I'm going to regret it in 10 years' time. And here I am 10 years later.
Now, one of the things about this department, I understand, is the fact that there's a real emphasis on applied science here. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's a very strong principle of our lab and other labs in the university that we focus not just on pure research, but always underpinning the fundamental research, there's a real actual application of the materials. Within our own lab, we're not just doing lab-scale synthesis. If we identify a promising material, we actually have a pilot plant where we can actually do the initial scale-up in-house. And this makes it very much more efficient, very much quicker to actually implement full-scale production if the pilot plant trials are successful.
And you've actually had some successes, haven't you, in transferring stuff from the lab to actual full-scale production?
Yes, so we now actually have three different types of materials being produced commercially. They're used as additives in agricultural plastic films for greenhouses to keep the temperature higher at night. They're used as environmentally friendly flame retardants in electric cable insulation, for example, and other areas. And they're also used as thermal stabilizers for PVC.
Now, in order to commercialize these sorts of things, the university can work with government as well to actually set up these sorts of plants, is that right?
Yes, so in many cases there's very joined up thinking. So that, for example, in one of the production plants we have in the northeast of China, the factory we collaborate with got a regional development grant from one scheme under the government. On the strength of that, was able to borrow money from the banks, which you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And then with the university putting the technology, then we've now set up the production line producing the material.
Now, as you said before, you've been working here for more than 10 years. When you first arrived, how unusual was it for a Westerner to be working in a Chinese university?
Doing science, there were very, very few. In fact, there still are. In the past, most Chinese students who went abroad to do PhDs or postdocs didn't come back. They've now seen that the facilities here, in many cases, are at least as good, and the opportunities are perhaps more because of things are growing so quickly. So that certainly now some overseas Chinese are coming back, and I'm sure that in the future there will be more Westerners like me who make China the place to build their career and their home.
So what's the effect been on science and technology in China of the last 10 years of this policy of openness and expansion and increasing international contact?
There's been an enormous expansion in funding, both in terms of applied research and also basic research. Certainly now, the labs we have here are comparable to what you would find in most labs in the UK or elsewhere in the West. I think when I came, you could describe what we had as out of the arc, whereas now it's much closer to state of the art.
So it's pretty clear that China is very quickly becoming a force to be reckoned with in cutting-edge chemistry. But I think the real sign that China has reached the big time will only come when people like David Evans are no longer considered unusual for having made their homes and careers here. And as the research base grows stronger, it seems almost inevitable that more and more scientists will want to follow him here.
Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow. And you can find out more about chemistry in China when Chemistry World launches its Chinese edition in September. You'll be able to find that online at chemistryworldchina.org. From that high note to a sad story now and why things are not looking so good for some players in the pharmaceutical sector, Victoria.
Well, one drug company in particular, GlaxoSmithKline, their very widely prescribed diabetes drug, Avandia, has come in for some pretty severe criticism from a meta-analysis that was conducted by Stephen Nissen at Cleveland Clinic in Ohio in the US. Now, he's a pretty influential figure. He is the man now famous for conducting the meta-analysis that highlighted the problem with Vioxx, Merck's anti-inflammatory treatment for arthritis, which has now been withdrawn. And there are a lot of lawsuits pending on the back of risks associated with that drug. He's done a similar thing with Avandia. He noticed a problematic pattern with cardiovascular risks in clinical trials that had been published by GSK. And so he conducted a meta-analysis with all of the clinical data that was available and concluded that indeed there was an increased risk of heart attack and death from heart attack.
That's a real blow, because when this family of drugs, these glitazone drugs, came out, everyone championed them, saying they can really transform the therapy of things like diabetes, which they're prescribed for. So what's going to be the spin-off? What's the implications of this finding?
You're quite right. They work by a different mechanism to other widely prescribed drugs, so they could be used in combination with existing drugs, which was brilliant for diabetes patients because there are very few drugs out there and some people find that therapies don't work for them. The immediate reaction has been one of just absolute panic. Patients have insisted that they be taken off this drug, and the share price of GSK plummeted. A few market analysts have estimated that the market share of Avandia, which was around about 10% of all prescriptions for type 2 diabetes patients, has fallen to around zero.
What about drugs like it? Because it's one of a family of agents. So are other companies with rival products, are they now worried? Were those included in this analysis?
The whole class was included in this analysis, but it particularly tackled Avandia because GSK had done such thorough clinical studies and published all of their studies and made them available to regulatory bodies like the FDA. But another drug that's in the same family that is available for prescription, Actos, which is produced by Takeda Pharmaceuticals, which is a partner of Lilly. And the same reaction has really occurred towards that drug as well. One of the things that has happened off the back of this is that the FDA and GSK have been involved in a meeting in Congress in the US, and the FDA off the back of this have insisted that GlaxoSmithKline put a black box warning, which is the most severe type of safety warning you can have on a drug. But this was for a different condition. This was for congestive heart failure. And apparently critics of the FDA and people within the FDA are now saying that they spotted this pattern a year ago and the FDA did nothing about it. So there's been a huge amount of reaction from the FDA, from the pharmaceutical industry, from patients and from clinicians. But it all seems to be still a little chaotic at the moment.
And we don't know who the precise patient groups are who are at risk. So you can't say we shouldn't prescribe it to this person because they could have this side effect, but this bunch, they'll be okay. We don't know who those people are.
Exactly. And the general advice is that you mustn't suddenly come off your medication. You must go to your GP and ask advice. But we don't know really what's going to happen with the actual drug itself and whether it's going to remain on the market. An advisory panel will be convened by the FDA on the 30th of July, and then the FDA will take a decision of whether the drug stays on the market or not.
Certainly a hard pill to swallow for some parts of the pharmaceutical industry. But good news now for anyone that's eager to shed a few years from their face. Cosmeceuticals, in other words, anti-aging and anti-wrinkle preparations, a huge business. And I caught up with Dale DeVore from Biofor Medical to find out what's on offer to reverse the effects of having a very well-lived-in body.
Instead of trying to reverse the effects, at this particular point we're developing implantable or injectable compositions that can be injected into some of these defects like nasolabial folds or marionette lines or other areas of the face in particular where you begin to see some of the aging events to fill in the voids.
What actually are the chemicals and how do they work? Obviously they take up space, but how do they manage to not aggravate the body's own tissues and cause problems?
The first products in this marketplace were composed of collagen, which would make a lot of sense, I guess, since the dermis is composed of collagen anyway. And the collagen was prepared from cattle hide, and it's well known in the literature from many years ago that collagen will solubilize in acid conditions. And then as you bring the pH back up where it was normally, physiological pH, pH of 7, collagen fibers begin to reform.
And there's no risk of people being allergic to them because you're injecting an animal into a human.
Yeah, there is. There are a certain percent of the population who do have an allergic response to bovine products in general, including bovine collagen.
Is there anything better we could use then?
Well, there are. I had a company in 1988 called Autogenesis where we thought it would be really nice to make a collagen from the person's own skin. And we developed a process where one would go in for a facelift or a stomach abdominoplasty or tummy tuck. We could obtain that skin, process the collagen into an injectable form and give it back to them. Strictly autologous, no potential for an allergic reaction. But there's a very small population of people who are willing to give up some of their skin to treat a wrinkle in their face.
But can you not, say, take a small bit of skin, get the cells out of it, and expand those?
Yeah.
And I'm referring to, of course, the cells that make collagen, and then just put them back in.
In some respects, that's being done now. There's a company called Isologen, and they take a small segment of skin and they expand the fibroblasts, because these are the cells that produce the extracellular matrix in skin, and they end up with millions of cells that they're then injecting into a wrinkle line. A number of years ago, Advanced Tissue Sciences in La Jolla, California developed a process for growing extracellular matrix from foreskin fibroblasts. So it's, again, it's a human preparation. This process is now being used to prepare another dermal filler, one called Cosmoderm and another called Cosmoplast. So these are truly cell-derived human collagen preparations. The big impact in this particular market occurred a couple years ago when hyaluronic acids were first approved for use in filling wrinkles, and it's expanded the market many times.
What actually are they? How do they work?
Well, the hyaluronic acids are long, high molecular weight polysaccharides. It's available from animal sources, but it's also available by fermentation. And the product itself is either non-cross-linked, but that would only last a short time because there are enzymes in the body that will break it down into smaller fragments. So the products that are currently effective in the market are cross-linked. And by putting a cross-link between molecules, you can develop a very high molecular weight material that can be prepared in a gelatinous form that can then be processed to make tiny particles.
And presumably they're not so readily degradable.
Exactly. Collagen only lasted 3, 4, maybe 6 months in some cases. This material is much more durable. It'll last 6 months.
So that sounds good. But what would you say, if you had to put your voting hat on, What's the hottest prospect on the market in terms of its anti-wrinkle effect right now?
I don't want to appear biased because I'm the vice president of Bioform Medical, but Bioform has a product called Radiesse, which is now recognized as the longer-lasting dermal filler. So we've gone from 3 months with collagens to 6 months with hyaluronic acid to longer than 6 months, which is what Radiesse is. And Radiesse is a product composed of calcium hydroxyapatite particles.
This is almost bone, isn't it?
It's the same material that's present in bone.
So don't you end up with a rather stony expression on your face if you
not
inject that then?
No, not at all. It's prepared in small particles, and it's placed at a certain concentration into a gel, a thick gel, and when injected into a wrinkle line, it does not appear or even feel like it has a bony appearance. It's a very massageable, formable material.
And where do you get the material from? Is it derived from just the patient, or is it entirely synthetic?
Oh, no, it's entirely synthetic.
Why does it last so long?
Well, it's kind of like if you have a bone chip in a body, it takes a long, long time for that to be removed because there really aren't enzymes. It's kind of a natural bioresorption over a period of time. So this material, it's very long-lasting.
And what will the price tag be? Is this going to be affordable for the average wrinkled person in the street, or do you have to be a Hollywood superstar that can already afford some kind of facelift to put it in?
The price of this material is comparable to the cost of the hyaluronic acids that are in the market today, particularly Restylane, which is the number one filler in the world. So it's comparable to it, but it lasts longer. So it's probably a better value for patients. You know, we've conducted a lot of studies like everyone else, and it's well known that you don't have to use as much of this material as you would some of the other filler products in the market. So, you know, it's a better value for the patient.
That was Bioform Medical's Dale DeVore. They've come up with Radiesse, which is a skin filler made from particles of hydroxyapatite, which stays in the tissue for long periods of time because it's the same stuff that makes up bone. Sounds unsavoury, but certainly not as nasty as the taste experience of mixing orange juice and toothpaste. But why?
My name is Jack Knight. I have 50 years' experience of being a flavourist. I'm originally an organic chemist. The question is, why does orange juice taste so strange after cleaning your teeth? Well, I don't normally drink orange juice immediately after cleaning my teeth, so I had to start by doing so. Was the taste so different from normal? Yes, it was. So why? I thought of three contributory factors. After brushing one's teeth, the mouth environment is very alkaline. I tested this idea by neutralising orange juice with sodium bicarbonate, which appeared to have a similar effect. Secondly, the orange retro aroma, that's the aroma that you get after you've taken the juice into your mouth, seemed very odd. This could be due to two causes. Either the effect of the surfactants in the toothpaste changed the apparent balance of the two major aroma constituents, decanal and linalool. It's well known that the retro aroma of orange in milk is extremely strange and the aldehydic character is much greater. But this effect will be very short-lived as the surfactants are easily removed from the mouth by rinsing. Finally, I came to the conclusion the main effect was that after the cooling effect of the toothpaste due to the presence of menthol, the orange aroma was modified, making it very objectionable. I tested this by adding a small amount of peppermint oil to orange juice and observed a similar effect in the taste of the juice. It looks as if the effect is the result of the cooling taste kinesthetic effect of menthol, which is quite long-lasting for at least 10 minutes on the taste of orange.
Thanks to Jack Knight for that answer. Here's next month's Chemical Conundrum.
Hello, I'm Ben from Wolverhampton. I'd just like to ask, why is it that wood changes colour as it ages?
So if you can help us with that, please drop us a line to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you can also use that address if you'd like to send us any feedback. That's it for this month's edition, which was produced and presented by me, Chris Smith, and Azzy Kateri from thenakedscientist.com, Chemistry World editor Mark Peplow, deputy editor B Perks, and science correspondents Victoria Gill, James Mitchell Crowe, and Richard Van Norden. For more science in the meantime, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. I'll be back next month, and until then, goodbye.